From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, conversations with John Updike. We'll go back to 1988, when he first joined us, and talked about growing up in a small town and becoming a writer. Then we'll feature a 1989 interview about his memoir, Self-Consciousness, which focused on what makes him most self-conscious about his physical self, like his psoriasis, stutter, and asthma. And we'll end the show with a new interview about his new novel, Brazil. Conversations with John Updike on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The stock market is reacting badly to the Federal Reserve's decision to raise short-term interest rates. Shortly before closing, the Dow has fallen about 87 points in very heavy trading. The central bank is raising short-term money market interest rates. The central bank says it wants to protect the country against any future increase in inflation. This is the first rise since 1989. The Fed generally doesn't announce these kinds of changes, but Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said he made the announcement to avoid misunderstandings of what the central bank is trying to do. United Airlines plans to schedule flights to Vietnam as soon as that nation and the United States approve them. NPR Cheryl Duvall has more.
Officials of Chicago-based United, which already flies several profitable routes across the Pacific Ocean, wasted no time after President Clinton Thursday lifted the trade embargo between the U.S. and Vietnam. The airline plans to operate Boeing 747 aircraft between Los Angeles and Ho Chi Minh City, with one as yet unnamed intermediate stop. In a written statement, company chairman Stephen Wolf emphasized the opportunity to reduce barriers and to promote economic ties between the two countries. The announcement contained no reference to the war that eventually ended regular flights from the U.S. to Vietnam or to some veterans' opposition to the resumption of commercial activity with that nation. As soon as possible, company officials said, United will begin flying the U.S. to Vietnam routes it acquired 8 years ago. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The Food and Drug Administration has given the protein hormone known as BST the go-ahead for marketing. The genetically engineered hormone will be injected into cows to increase milk production. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
The hormone somatotropin is secreted by the pituitary gland in cows. It's responsible for milk production. A synthetic version known as BST increases milk production in cows by about a gallon a day. The FDA has concluded after 9 years of study that BST is safe, but at least 150 dairies and food producers nationwide say they won't use BST-treated milk, arguing the hormone causes health problems. Miriam Erickson Brown of the Anderson Erickson Dairy in Des Moines disagrees.
We know right now that the use of genetically engineered BST is not a health or safety issue. It's an economic issue decided by farmers on the farm level.
BST-treated milk will be on grocery store shelves within a few days. Labeling of milk from herds using BST is not required. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
The Labor Department says unemployment rose to 6.7% in January. That's mainly due to a new way of calculating the jobless rate. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is taking a beating. It's down 97 points at 3,870. The NASDAQ is down 19 at 778. This is NPR. NASA says almost everything is going well aboard the space shuttle Discovery. It's the first mission to carry a Russian cosmonaut as a crew member. Astronauts are gearing up for the main event of the 8-day mission, the release of the Wakefield facility. That's a saucer-like satellite designed to plow through space. It'll create a near-perfect vacuum in its wake. Scientists hope to use the vacuum to create materials for super-fast computer chips. A South African right-wing radio station is being given a broadcast license. The government had threatened to close it down. Radio Pretoria is among 15 stations being permitted to broadcast under new licensing laws. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The decision to grant Radio Pretoria a license is the consequence of political pragmatism. The government may know that a showdown with the right wing is inevitable, but it does not want to be dragged into a premature battle over a small radio station. However, the ANC is likely to use the granting of a license as a stick with which to beat the government. Nelson Mandela, touring in the Orange Free State, accused President de Klerk of being weak in his dealings with the far right. The government's security advisers have warned that the right is preparing for war. A series of bomb blasts in the Orange Free State and the Western Transvaal seem to confirm that a heightened level of extremist violence may be imminent. When or where the real explosion of rightist anger will come, nobody knows. What is certain is that the ANC will have to place its faith largely in the loyalty of the security forces and the steady nerve of F.W. de Klerk.
The BBC's Fergal Keane reporting. The government's head of the Bureau of Lands Management has resigned, and environmentalists are angry. Jim Baca has left his job rather than take another within the Interior Department. He's a strong advocate of protection of federal lands against grazing and mining abuse. His department governs more than 260 million acres of land. Several environmental groups say he was forced out. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Updike is generally acknowledged as one of the most important living American writers. He's won just about all the big literary awards, including the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. His 16 novels include The Rabbit Series, The Centaur, Beck, A Book, The Witches of Eastwick, Memories of the Ford Administration, and Brazil, which was just published. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Updike several times. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're going to feature two interviews with Updike from the 80s and a new interview about his new novel, Brazil. Updike grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, not unlike the setting of his book Rabbit Run. After graduating from Harvard, he joined the staff of The New Yorker magazine in 1955. Although he left the staff 2 years later, he maintained a close association with the magazine, which continues to publish his book reviews and short stories. Our first interview was recorded in 1988, after the publication of his novel S, which completed his trilogy of books inspired by Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel The Scarlet Letter. In the mid-60s, Updike said that his subject was the American Protestant small-town middle class, and that middles especially interested him. I asked him if that was still true.
Like many things that you've said and had quoted back at you, you sort of wish to move on in a way, and I wouldn't quite phrase it that way. But as a matter of fact, yes, I do still live in a smallish town, and I do still seem to write about people who are somewhat in the middle. But I don't feel it as a cause quite the way I did. I write about more or less everything I can think of. That is, I stretch my imagination as far as it'll go. And there is, I am kind of stuck in the middle as far as my life goes, and hence my imagination tends to zero in on things which are indeed in the middle. That is, I don't write about the very rich, who I scarcely know, or the very poor, who I don't know very well either.
Do you think your novels are getting less autobiographical as you get older?
I would say, yes, they are slightly. I'm trying to, you know, I am older, and so I've seen more life, and I should be somewhat wiser and should have a certain repertoire of stored images from other lives that I can draw on, and I'm trying to use it. Certainly, yes. Only the innermost essence of my heroine could be called me. The rest is all made up, and indeed her age is nowhere near mine, and in writing about her, I had to sort of rethink what her past would have been. On the other hand, in my own defense, not that you're attacking me, I would say that all of my novels have been somewhat unautobiographical. In every case, there was something that kind of stretched me, and in a way, there was as well as the facts and things I had seen and cities I had visited. There was always something which was not true of me. I was never a basketball star like Harry Angstrom. And I was never a black dictator like Eleanor in The Coup. So always, I think, for a novel, there has to be something out of the autobiographical to excite the author, and one hopes to excite then the reader.
You know, most of your novels have been about people from the middle class, but I think there's something in your life that you've never done in a way that's always a part of the middle class, and that is reporting to work, reporting for a job. You work at The New Yorker for a couple of years back in the mid-50s, but you've been a writer all your life and have been able to make a living from it, which meant that, you know, you never had to go to work.
I've never...
out at a job, out in an office or a plant or something like that.
No, exactly so, and I think it is an area of American experience which most people have and which I have by my own early and lucky success have somewhat skipped. And I'm sorry, in a way, you know, I'm sorry I did not, unlike Joseph Conrad, ship out and be a Marine captain for many years, because it gave him, when he did, Conrad, sit down to write, it gave him a lot of things to write about. He never was in danger of running out of material. I did have a number of jobs as a teenager, and I did watch my father go off to work every day, and I've lived among commuters so much of my life, so I don't feel entirely locked out. But you're right, I began to write quite early and to get published early, and to some extent it's made me an oddball and a bit to one side of the mainstream of American experience.
Have you ever had the desire to go try out a very unusual experience that would take you far away from your life so that you could use it in your writing? I guess what I'm thinking is, between your own writing and all the reading that you do for the books that you review, you really have to be home a lot reading and writing.
I'm home a fair amount and do enjoy trips and have taken a number of them with the idea of expanding my horizons and perhaps leading me to some new room of reality. Africa was the main trip I took. I've been there a couple times, and
you've written about it in one of your
novels. I've written about it. I finally used it both in a few short stories and also in a novel called The Coup. So that was one place that did seem exotic and interesting to me, and I wanted to get there, and I did get there, and I did write about it. Every writer has to find some balance, surely, between being at home and doing the work and getting out and living and seeing the world. And I've maybe stuck to my desk more than most, but plan in the future to, you know, to get away a bit. Also, I think we have to, just to let ourselves know that there's more to the world than our desk and our... And our window out.
You've extolled accuracy in writing, accuracy in describing the details of objects and settings and of people and their lives. Why is that kind of detail so important?
Well, I find that the main charge, let's call it, that I get out of writing is when I feel I've gotten something down accurately. And the main bliss, whether I read Henry Greene or Nabokov or Proust or Tolstoy, is the sense that they've described precisely a certain moment of experience, whether it's a dress or a chair or how a person's face looks, that really the literary art is a parasitic one and that its energy comes from the energy of the real. And so accuracy is one way of describing the close approximation to the real that we all sort of live for. There's other kinds of accuracy, of course. There is the larger attempt to, in the shape of your novels, to give something of the texture and the ambiguity of life itself, which makes perhaps for novels that don't end as conclusively and as satisfyingly as 19th century novels did. But I think it's our fate as 20th century people to live with ambiguity, and so I've tried to make my books in some sense reflect the ambiguity as it exists.
Do you think that great novels have more to do with perfect pitch than they do with great stories or great themes?
I think the storytelling instinct has to be part of the writer's equipment, and that in the end the novels that we treasure as classics are those which tell a pretty solid story. And it's The Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick and Huckleberry Finn, to name three American classics, all have a strong storyline that you can retain in your mind. So I would say that this is one piece and maybe the main piece of the puzzle. But having the story in your mind, then I think it's the sentence-to-sentence pleasures, the little surprises of a surprising style of an acute style, and also the way things happen one after the other that makes a book interesting to read page to page. So that you try to do both things. You try to have the page to page interestingness, that any page of a novel could be ripped out and read as kind of a poem. That plus the fact that when the book is closed, some kind of whole image will be in your mind and please you, or at least, yeah, that in some ways your mind will have been changed by the book.
You review a lot of books, and You once wrote that when you review a book, you should review the book and not the writer's reputation. With the reputation that you have as a great American writer, do you find that it's frequently your reputation and not your latest book that gets reviewed?
I feel that less lately than formerly. I did feel as though a number of critics had appointed themselves when they sat down with a new book of mine to rectify what they felt to be was my inflated reputation. And so that the book at hand was not really given a chance, but made a kind of weapon in the general attempt to bring me down to size. I've tried to avoid doing that to other other writers. And I must say, and maybe I should knock on wood, is that the last couple books of mine have been reviewed in, I think, a basically fair, a fair and attentive way. And all a writer can ask, really, is that the reviewer read the book and say what he thinks about it, instead of trying to readjust the American literary scene by means of this book review.
Does the critic in you ever threaten to stifle the novelist in you?
Yes, all the time he threatens to do that, and I kind of sidled into reviewing. I never really set out to be a critic, and my mother didn't raise me to be a critic, but in the 60s it seemed a convenient and nice thing to do. I had a number of authors who I was enthusiastic about, and I wanted to share my enthusiasm with the reader, and so it's gone now for 30 years. And I've reviewed a lot of books and would like to review less in the future than I have in the past. But yeah, it's not good to think very critically when you're trying to write because...
Well, I should think you'd be afraid to write. Do you
know
what I mean?
Yes.
Because you're saying, this could be better. There must be a better word than this.
Any sentence could be stifled by the critic in one if you allow him to get the upper hand. But by and large, and keeping in mind that I am a little wary of the critic in me, I think once you start to try to put images and words of dialogue together, that in some way the imaginary world takes over and mercifully shuts out all these harassing critical thoughts that you might otherwise entertain.
My guest is John Updike. You wrote a satire of the literary life called Beck, a Book, one of your novels. And the literary figure who you write about in there is a Jewish novelist. And I wonder if you felt that when you were coming of age that many of your peers who were coming of age as writers were Jewish.
They were. And they are collectively and one by one the chief glory of post-war American literature. It has been a Jewish and urban. I'm Protestant and kind of a country boy, so I did feel that occasionally I was chastised for writing out of such an unfashionable corner of American experience. But I persevered because it was the only corner I had, and who knows what went into the creation of Henry Beck. For one thing, a writer, especially as he ages and if he has some success, has experiences which only a writer could have. So it was helpful to me to invent a fictional writer, and I tried to make him as unlike myself as I could. Instead of a father of four, he's an unwed and bachelor, and he is Jewish and urban. Which is, in a way, something I would like to be.
Jewish and urban?
Yes, I think it'd be nice and kind of lively and a lot of fun, as I imagined it, really, although Beck's life isn't all fun. It's been fun for me to try to imagine myself into the skin and the mind of Henry Beck.
You feel that you missed out on something because you don't have, you know, a kind of obvious ethnic heritage, because WASPs in this country are not assumed to have, you know, the kind of, like, ethnic... sense of past that, say, Jews do. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You don't have a subject quite in the way that the Jewish writers of a certain transitional generation did. It's true. And I was raised in a town that did not have much ethnic self-awareness because basically it was all Protestant, all white, all Gentile. On the other hand, it was in Pennsylvania. We had a sharp sense of ourselves as Pennsylvanians, and there was a feeling that there was something here, that we did have an identity. I don't feel exactly that, you know, it's like water. It's more like like milk. That is, there is a color, even if it's white, and even if the milk is a little stale now in the glass. So, you know, I think any life has in it enough material, enough points of departure to fuel a writer's career, and that we shouldn't worry about what we're not, but to try to focus on what we are and what we do know.
I want to talk with you more about your writing and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer John Updike. His new novel is titled S. This is Fresh Air. Writer John Updike is my guest. You grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania where I'm sure there wasn't a big writer's community.
to say the least.
Did writers seem somewhat magical to you growing up away from writers and away from the publishing world?
Yes, the whole world seemed magical. There was, however, my mother, who was trying to be a writer, so that the basic tools of writing, that is, the typewriter and the paper and the manila envelopes, were all in the house, and I used to watch her type and used to watch her send the things off and hope for the best. And eventually she did get published, although perhaps never as much as her gifts deserved. So that there was my mother, there was some literary activity in the nearby city of Reading, and we're talking about an eastern area, basically, which was only a train ride from New York City. So although it seemed quite magical and distant, it was not as distant and magical as it might have seemed to a boy, say, from Alaska or Nevada.
Your father was a math teacher in your high school, and I believe you even had classes with him. You know, most of us as children never got to judge our fathers at the work that they did, because the work that they did was far away from where we were, and what did we know about it? You know, what did we know about their professions or their factories or whatever? But all students evaluate their teachers, so you knew your father in a kind of different level than most of us know ours?
It was a strange exposure. Yeah, my father taught to junior high math, and I was his student for not one but 3 years, all those junior high years. Indeed, he was my homeroom teacher for one of those years. And what can I say, except that he made it kind of painless. I was not pressured to behave better than the other children, and he somehow continued to express paternal feelings toward me when I was not in class. And luckily, I was a good student and liked math, so there wasn't really any basic conflict. But yes, it is a strange thing to see your father at work, as it were. And what I got out of it was mostly, well, two things, really. A sense of pride seeing him perform, because I saw him in high school assemblies, and he was the funniest of the teachers and would say things which would make the whole auditorium roar with laughter. And I thought, crouching down on my seat, that that's my dad, and was kind of amazed. On the other hand, I did see, especially as he got older, the real struggle that teaching is, and keeping discipline and saying the same things for the 15th year in a row. And so a curious sense of his agony, that is, the agony of the working teacher, was borne in upon me also.
Well, you must have been known at least partially in school as your father's son, since everyone knew who he was and who you were. Was it a relief when you left home to just not be known as your father's son?
I think the pressure on teachers' children, and there were a number in my class, and on ministers' children in a small town, there is a certain pressure or expectation that you will be good. And since I basically was kind of timid and good, it wasn't an inordinate pressure on me, but I both enjoyed the role, kind of. It did give me a tiny bit of celebrity in this small town, and in a way was happy to get out of Shillington into an area where nobody knew me or my father or my grandfather. Yes, it was a kind of a relief.
My guest is writer John Updike. You know, for years I'd really hoped that I'd someday have the opportunity to do an interview with you, but I was very scared of it as well, because you really dislike interviewing? I mean, you dislike being interviewed and you dislike the form. You've called interviews a form to be loathed. I think of all the people I've ever met, you really have the strongest anti-interview feelings.
And yet I've given my share of interviews,
I know, as you may notice.
And I seem to be giving more and more, too, which just goes to show that these higher principles. But I think what I was objecting to mostly when I made the remark about them being a half form like maggots and a form to be loathed is that once you've put yourself on record in an interview and you're sort of thinking fast and saying the first thing that pops into your mind, basically anything to fill up the airtime or the reporter's time, it's a little disconcerting when you're younger than I to realize that these remarks, which you toss off once they're in print, have an equal weight with all the words that you've labored to polish and make come out exactly right. So in some sense, I do resist and resent the tendency of our age to milk people through interviews to get them to betray or to reveal the real whoever, John Updike, let's say, when John Updike has been trying to show the real John Updike in his writing all these years. However, it's like traffic jams and flying in jet planes. It's part of our penance for living in the 20th century.
Well, listen, thanks for doing the interview. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of more questions for you. Do you mind if I quote you one more time?
No, it's fun to hear it.
You said that an artist of any sort in our society and most others is a privileged person allowed to stand apart from some of the daily grind and supposed to be closer to the gods and to have access to the divine sources of tribal well-being. This is quite a responsibility. And I'm not sure if you think that that's an appropriate way of seeing an artist or if you think that that's an absurd way to see artists.
There's been quite a lot said by the classic modernists, Wallace Stevens and James Joyce and others, and Proust also, about the sacred importance of the writer and about their sense that the God being either dead or asleep, that the writer has inherited what once was the priest's function. And this certainly enabled the modernists, that is, this high concept of their importance, to write marvelous stuff. That is, to do anything well, you have to believe in it. And such a creed enabled them to believe enough to devote their lives to writing well. I don't know as I quite subscribe to this elevated notion of the writer's role, but I think people do look to us to tell the truth in a way that nobody else quite will, not politicians or ministers or sociologists. A writer's job is to, by way of fiction, somehow describe the way we live. And to me, this seems an important task, very worth doing, and I think also to the reading public, it seems, even though they might not articulate it, it seems to them something worth doing also. In a way, what you are doing is you are giving, Pascal said this somewhere, you're giving back people themselves. You are, by describing as best you can the fantasies of your own life, you are showing other people what their lives are like. And in a way, you are giving people life, you are clarifying their life for them. And so this is not an insignificant task, is it?
No, that's a great way of looking at it, too. I want to thank you so very much for speaking with us. Thank you very much for doing the interview.
Thank you very much.
John Updike, recorded in 1988. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More interviews with John Updike in the second part of this archive edition.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Until his 1989 memoir, Self-Consciousness, John Updike was reluctant to reveal much about himself to his readers. His memoir zeroed in on things that make him most self-conscious, like his psoriasis and a stutter. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1989 interview about that memoir. Then a new interview with Updike about his new novel, Brazil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has raised short-term interest rates for the first time in nearly 5 years. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
The secretive Fed took the unusual step of announcing its intention to push up short-term interest rates this morning. After a meeting of its policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said the FOMC had decided it needed to take a more restrictive credit stance to sustain and enhance the economic expansion. Sources said the central bank had become concerned that the expansion could begin to strain the economy's capacity to grow without higher inflation. A half hour later, the Fed took action in the market for bank reserves to nudge the key federal funds rate from 3% to 3.25%. Some banks wasted little time hiking loan rates. Greenspan had said Monday rates were abnormally low and would have to be raised soon, and his warning raised no hackles in the Clinton administration. After the Fed had followed through and raised rates, Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said he had expected it and said it should not hurt the economy. He said he respects the Fed's independence. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The Dow has taken the news badly, falling more than 95 points. Supporters and opponents of a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution have traded charges today. The Senate is getting ready to debate the measure later this month. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The group Families USA says the deep cuts required to balance the budget would devastate the economy and target poor and elderly Americans. Director Ron Pollack especially criticizes the amendment's provision that puts Social Security surpluses in the same pot as general government revenues.
The balanced budget amendment is a raid on Social Security, and the American people, seniors and people with disabilities in particular, will fight that amendment with as much vigor as they can muster.
The amendment's main author, Senator Paul Simon, disputes the claim that Social Security will bear the brunt of the cuts and Pollack's assumption that Congress will not raise taxes. Simon adds that all federal programs are threatened if the deficit remains out of control. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
A Chicago woman who's charged with neglecting her children blames the squalid condition of her apartment on police who raided it. They were looking for drugs and didn't find any, but they did discover 19 neglected kids. The children have been turned over to child welfare authorities. Mae Melton says the police who entered her apartment spilled clothing and garbage on the floor. She says the neglect and abuse charges are lies. She and six adults have been charged in the case. The Chicago caseworkers who tried to get into the apartment reportedly gave up after three times. The Chicago caseworker has been suspended for not trying hard enough. On Wall Street, stocks have tumbled. The Dow plunged 96 points to end 38.71. This is NPR. The U.S. Figure Skating Association is meeting in Colorado Springs to discuss Tanya Harding's case. A special panel is reviewing all evidence gathered in connection with the attack on Nancy Kerrigan. Harding's ex-husband has pleaded guilty to planning the attack. He says Harding was in on it from the beginning. She's maintained she knew nothing of the plot before it happened. The panel will decide if Harding has violated the Olympic Code. If the panel agrees to let Harding compete, she could still be prevented from skating by the U.S. Olympic Committee or the International Olympic Committee. A federal court jury in Cleveland has awarded $1.3 million to a woman who was injured in a U.S. air crash at New York's LaGuardia Airport. Mary Garrity, a member station WCPN, reports.
Denise Miller had asked the jury for $8 million for her physical and emotional injuries suffered when Cleveland-bound Flight 405 plunged into frigid waters in March of 1992. Miller swallowed jet fuel and suffered broken bones and third-degree burns. Her father was killed in the crash. The jury also awarded $50,000 to Miller's husband for loss of her companionship and support. The awards come after Chief Judge Thomas Lambros ruled that U.S. Air must pay compensatory damages because the airline was negligent for allowing the plane to attempt takeoff with ice on its wings. 24 more U.S. Air cases are scheduled for trial here over the next 3 months. For National Public Radio, this is Mary Garrity in Cleveland.
Nissan is going to buy back 33,000 of its minivans. Some of them are as much as 7 years old. The automaker will offer owners the current retail value of the minivans, an average of more than $6,000, plus a $500 coupon. Nissan will spend more than $200 million on the buyback plan. The automakers want to get rid of the model because the vehicle is plagued with engine fires. No one has been seriously hurt in one. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. We're devoting this archive edition of the show to a series of interviews with one of America's most important writers, John Updike. In spite of his achievements, Updike has tried to keep a relatively low public profile, and during most of his career, he's been reticent to reveal much about his personal life to his readers. But he reflects on his life in his 1989 memoir, Self-Consciousness. The interview we're about to hear was recorded right after its publication. Our interview began with Updike reading the opening paragraph of his memoir, which explains why he uncharacteristically chose himself as the subject of a book.
Shortly before the first of these personal essays was composed, but several years after the soft spring night in Shillington that it describes, I was told, perhaps in jest, of someone wanting to write my biography, to take my life, my load of ore and heap of memories, from me. The idea seemed so repulsive that I was stimulated to put down, always with some natural hesitation and distaste, these elements of an autobiography. They record what seems to me important about my own life, and try to treat this life, this massive datum which happens to be mine, as a specimen life, representative in its odd uniqueness of all the oddly unique lives in this world. A mode of impersonal egoism was my aim, an attempt to touch honestly upon the central veins with a scientific dispassion and curiosity.
Can you explain that fear of somebody taking your memories from you to write a biography?
Well, a writer's life isn't quite like a statesman's life, you know. It's what you write out of, and I just didn't want to be, and don't want to be intruded upon in that way. So as a defense against intrusion, I decided to invade my own privacy with these essays. At least I would know how to do it and would do it with good taste and delicately, and I'd know where to go. And if my life is of any intrinsic interest, and I'm not sure it is of much, I'm the one who's lived it, and the kind of things that I write about in this book are certainly things that a biographer would not fasten upon.
Are there any things that you dislike about the form of memoirs that you tried to avoid in your own?
Well, I tried to avoid a merely sequential account of events. In my case, there aren't that many events in my life. The main events, aside from the births of my children and my two marriages and the deaths of my seniors, have been the books themselves. So the biography is quite adequately stated on the back of the jacket, really, in a few words. There is no life except seen poetically, as it were, seen with a metaphysical search in mind.
Well, the poetic device you seem to use is your body. The revelations in the central part of, you know, in the middle part of your memoirs, come not from your career as a writer, but from your body, from physical ailments, from psoriasis, from a stutter, from asthma.
Yes, well, they what seemed to come to my attention of those moments of discomfort. And remember, the title of the book is Self-Consciousness, so I fastened upon those things which either made me self-conscious, like the psoriasis, or which showed self-consciousness, like the stuttering.
You first got psoriasis in kindergarten in 1938. Did people in the literary world know that you had a skin problem before you wrote about it?
I don't know. I suppose some did. I wrote a kind of amusing, I've always thought, short story called Journal of a Leper, or From the Journal of a Leper, which is about psoriasis, and which is much quoted in medical texts of a certain kind. Psoriasis is rather rarely written about. We're all shy about it, those of us who have it, and wish we didn't and don't want to talk about it much. So it took a long time for me to confess to it. I feel it's some, you know, it's a sin of some kind. It's a dermal sin, and it took me a long time to believe that it wasn't really my fault, and I could talk about it more or less freely. No, I don't think it was commonly known. I'm told it doesn't really much show, and the discomfort has mostly been self-produced rather than other people produced.
Well, I think you found a lot of universals in the particulars of your experience with psoriasis, and I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on psoriasis, and my guest is John Updike, and this is a reading from his new book, Self-Consciousness.
Psoriasis keeps you thinking. Strategies of concealment ramify, and self-examination is endless. You are forced to the mirror again and again. Psoriasis compels narcissism. If we can suppose a narcissist who did not like what he saw, in certain lights, your face looks passable. In slightly different other lights, not. Shaving mirrors and rearview mirrors in automobiles are merciless, whereas the smoky mirrors in airplane bathrooms are especially flattering and soothing. One's face looks as tawny as a movie star's. Flying back from the Caribbean, I used to admire my improved looks. Years went by before I noticed that I looked equally good in the lavatory glow on the flight down. I cannot pass a reflecting surface on the street without glancing in hopes that I have somehow changed. Nature and the self, the great moieties of earthly existence, are each cloven in two by a fascinated ambivalence. One hates one's abnormal, erupting skin, but is led into a brooding, solicitous attention toward it. One hates the nature that has imposed this affliction, but only this same nature can be appealed to for erasure, for cure. Only nature can forgive psoriasis. The sufferer, in his self-contempt, does not grant to other people this power.
There's a sentence in there that I think probably a lot of people will really see themselves in, and that is, I cannot pass reflecting surface on the street without glancing in the hopes that I have somehow changed. I really think you put your finger on something there.
Well, I'm happy to hear it, because I've always thought that nobody except me was annoyed with the way they looked or self-conscious to this degree, but I guess we all are. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to be born into a certain body instead of an ideal body, and all of our faces, the whole idea of a face is some slightly funny, isn't it? If you can put yourself outside of the species a moment, these faces we carry around with the holes in them and the shining holes and the dark holes and then the one that shows a lot of teeth, it's all odd beyond belief, really.
Yeah, well, you feel like, well, it's my face, but my face isn't my fault.
Right, it's not your fault, but it is what you're stuck with.
Well, you seem to think that it's some of your weaknesses that have made you what you are, some of your defects, like psoriasis. You think that you became the person who you are and the writer who you are because of it.
Well, I think it forced my attention away from any very public career, like being an actor or a school teacher, which is a kind of actor, and what my father did, and was that was the profession that society had more or less laid out for me. And I think my determination to avoid teaching isn't part of shyness of any kind of public performance daily, putting yourself there, trying to look good. So I've been extra serious about making it as a freelance writer, where I don't really have to come out of the closet, where I can do the whole thing at a distance and in a room by myself via the mails.
John Updike is my guest. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1989 interview with John Updike, recorded after the publication of his memoir, Self-Consciousness.
I want you to read another paragraph from your book, and this is from John Updike's new memoir, Self-Consciousness. And we were talking before about really so much of your body comes into play in this set of memoirs. And this is related to a chapter about asthma, and you associate asthma with a period when you tried to break out of your marriage and initially failed and then later actually broke out of it.
Yes, I did, and I hope, and I will read the section which, under the heading of trying to tell the truth. I go from stuttering in this chapter to breathing, and I think there's some swallowing in there.
Choking,
too.
Yeah.
Choking, which I did used to do. There's a kind of a claustrophobia, something very curious to me about the throat as the passageway whereby the heart and the head communicate. Anyway, I'm more conscious of that narrow passageway. And this is about asthma and my domestic feelings at the time, my life situation. A door had opened and shut. My timidity and conscience had slammed it shut. My wife and children were my captors, but I could not blame them. They had done nothing after all but come when I called. When young, I'd wanted a wife who would be attractive and motherly and artistic and quiet, and she materialized. We wanted children, and they obediently came, healthy and lovable, and two of each sex. Now, through no fault of their own, they composed a household whose walls seemed to be shrinking around me, squeezing my chest. No first attack stands in my memory. The squeezing, the panic crept in, and were suddenly there. Like my Barth reading and my poetry writing, for I was never more of a poet than in this angst-besmogged period, the breathlessness would tend to come on in the evening. We didn't know what it was, pure inner demons, or an ingenious psychosomatic mechanism to make my wife feel guilty about being still married to me, or what.
This is the first time you've written that I know of directly about your family, and you don't write that much about your family in your memoir, but I guess I was wondering what if your family was ever offended by things that you'd said about families in fiction, in your novels, that they assumed to be about themselves.
I've been surrounded by very kind and good families, beginning with my parents. My mother, after all, thought it would be a good thing to become a writer, so she's taken her medicine as I've written with good grace. And my father was an immensely encouraging and forbearing man. And my first wife and my second wife could both be described as very kind women who see, of course, that writing is what I do. Every profession has its handicaps, and a certain amount of telling is a risk you run if you get mixed up with a writer. Now, my children didn't ask for this. They were just born. And for the 15 years when I wrote mostly about families, they weren't reading me, and I was grateful for that. But certainly I said nothing about them that they couldn't read. And fiction is, let's not forget, fiction. A writer who undertakes to tell a story is under no obligation to real people, really. Your obligation is to the reader and to create something that makes sense as a work of fiction.
John Updike, recorded in 1989 after the publication of his memoir, Self-Consciousness. Updike reads from his new novel, Brazil, in a minute. This is Fresh Air.
Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Interest rates in America might be going up just a bit because of today's announcement that the Federal Reserve is raising the rates for short-term loans by 0.25%. Robert Siegel talks with an American entrepreneur in Ho Chi Minh City about the lifting of the trade embargo that's been in effect for 19 years against Vietnam. I'll have a discussion about milk labeling with Consumers Union. The group recommends asking your grocery store if their milk contains the synthetic growth hormone, BGH. David Mopus reports from Mississippi on the trial of Byron DeLay Beckwith for the murder of Medgar Evers. And Bob Mondello reviews Romeo is Bleeding.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our show today has featured interviews from our archives with writer John Updike. We're closing the show with an interview we recorded this week about his new novel, Brazil. Novelist Scott Spencer once wrote that Updike's genius is apparent in his use of passionately poetic language to describe a world utterly and unalterably everyday. Updike's new novel takes him far from his everyday life. It's set in Brazil, and it's about the love between a black man from the slums of Rio and a white woman from a wealthy family. Their love is threatened by everything from her parents, who turn against them, to poverty and enslavement. Part of the novel is inspired by the magic realism of Latin American writers like Marquez and Borges. I told Updike that I thought much of his fiction has a kind of skepticism, realism, and modernity that seems in opposition to magic.
The author with the blank page in front of him, of course, can make magic happen very easily. Every sentence you write down is, in a way, bringing something out of nothing, and you can change people's colors very easily with the change of an adjective. But it is a freedom you're aware of as you write, and so for the author it's perhaps less of a leap than it is for the reader, who expects a credible, plausible version of our world where, alas, miracles and magic are in quite short supply. But I tried to make the magic in this book understandable internally as well as externally. That is, in some way, it's a wish fulfillment of what the people want. So in that way, it's a plant, a flower that comes out of reality, but the flower is magic.
Do you have any belief anywhere in your heart in magic?
Probably not. You know, I'm a math teacher's son and kind of skeptical. On the other hand, there's something magical about just our existence, isn't there, of being an ego inside this machine and being me instead of you, and the way the planet is so green and lovely in the midst of all this barren emptiness. I think, in a way, there's enough magic in reality so that I can't say I don't believe in any magic.
I want you to read a short passage in which Isabel goes to a shaman and asks him to work his magic on her and her lover. Would you explain the kind of magic she wants him to work?
Yes, she is at the end of quite a long and perilous trip, which she's taken with a young Indian woman, a co-wife, actually. At this point, she's the wife of a Bandarache, who is a 18th century explorer and predator. In brief, Tristan's, her lover's blackness, has got them into a lot of trouble with her family. And as a gift of love, she wants to change his color. And she's sufficiently deep into Brazil that she's reached an area where this kind of magic might occur. Anyway, she has heard of a magician who lives on top of a mesa, and she finally gets there and is now interviewing him. His name is Tejucupapo, and you'll have to forgive if I mispronounce anything in here.
You're just the author, it's all right.
Well, being an author doesn't mean you can pronounce all of the words you use, alas. The names I got, I think, out of Levi Strauss, where he talks about Indian friends of his. And he addresses her as Maira, which is the way the white men were first addressed when they came by the Indians. It means a kind of a god. It's as if you addressed a stranger as Jesus or Christ. I mean, it's a salute of a kind. Maira, he asks her, what is it you want my magic to do? As she explained, the shaman's browless eyes widened and his toothless jaw opened at first in incomprehension and then in comprehension. He said, as far as she could understand, I should explain that they don't speak the same language, but he has had her smoke a certain tobacco, a kind of tobacco that enables her to understand. She's on a kind of mystical trip, as it were, in which some of his words make enough sense. So she hears him saying, magic is a way of adjusting nature. Nothing can be created. Only Monan, the god above, can create. And he long ago grew tired of creating because he saw what a mess men had made of his world. Magic can merely transpose and substitute, as with the counters of a game. When something here is placed there,
Something there must be placed here. For every grain there is a sacrifice somewhere else. Do you understand?
I understand, she says.
Are you willing to sacrifice for this Tristan?
I already have. I have lost my world. I have lost my father.
Are you willing to change yourself?
Yes, if he will still love me.
He will still love you, but not in the same way. When we disturb nature with magic, nothing stays the same. Things shift.
His eyes had narrowed again and looked blazingly red with the smoke and the kaim. I am willing. I am eager.
I like your description of magic, that every time something here is placed there, something there must be placed here. So for every action, there's a reaction. Do you want to describe what the reaction is to the magic she asks to be worked?
Well, yes, she can only turn him white by herself becoming black. And so he paints her. He paints her with a juice and blows this magic smoke on her. And she, having gone in as a white woman, comes out as a black woman. And as such, she has her own charms, and their romance continues, but is kind of flipped, as it were, and takes on a different timbre, both in the sex and the way that they relate to each other. The novel is very much about skin, in a way, but not just skin, because having a black skin changes things inside as well as outside.
Were you interested in magic or in fairy tales when you were young?
To a degree. Not as interested as my parents or as my mother would have liked me to be. I remember that most fairy tales somewhat scared me. I think the Grimm tales, Grimm, of course, especially penetrated my Germanic mind, and some of them are lessons to live by. I remember especially one tale in which a woman wishes, for every wish she loses a piece of a hide, a magic hide hung on her wall, and eventually she uses the hide up, and that somehow struck me as what life was like, and I've gone through it making wishes, and when they're granted, you tend to lose a piece of that magic hide.
Is that how you feel?
A little. For everything you get that you want, you also lose something. Life is gain and loss, and in the end, maybe a touch more loss than gain.
It's kind of like your definition of magic in the book.
It is, and the sense of replacement. You know, at the heart of the Christian faith is this strange act of substitution and sacrifice. Somehow God just couldn't forgive the world. He had to send his son to be sacrificed. So the notion that magic is a displacement, that it's not something out of nothing, only God can do that, but you have to rearrange. It's a rearrangement of the world. And so both magic and engineering come in the same box in a way.
Well, John Updike, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Updike's new novel is called Brazil. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.